Hi, my name is Dennis, and I am an alcoholic. Spirituality, man, I'm sitting in a room full of it right now. You guys are on fire. I got here yesterday, and it was just like the light to find. You guys are just amazing. Spirituality. You know, when I found out that I was going to speak, it was one of those where I get the opportunity to share. It was one of those where my first thoughts are, what am I going to share about? What do I know about spirituality? You know, and then I had to stop and think about the words of one of my sponsors in early sobriety. And he always used to tell me that I was always right where I needed to be. And I hated that saying. You know, because I was in pain, I was in misery, I felt horrible, and I just didn't want to go on. Today I get it. Today I understand what that means in my life today. I'm not from Phoenix, Arizona, or from Arizona. I moved here from Colorado. Yeah, live back there for my kids, I love it. You know, and I got tricked into coming here. You know, and this gentleman held a price tag over my head, and he said, here's the deal. You know, I come down here, I did some work for him, and he liked what I did. And he took me to Mexico and showed me a great time down there, and the next thing I know, we were on our way back. I don't remember much about Mexico. I know that you can get in a taxi and go anywhere and get anything you want. And to me, that was all that mattered. Because I was living in self-will. And on the way back, he offered me an opportunity to go down there and build houses for him. And the one thing that he did was he put a stipulation on that. He said that I had to complete a treatment program and get a certificate that showed that I had completed this program. And that's kind of how my journey in recovery started. So I had this opportunity, and things in Colorado for me were not looking really good. I don't know, but I have some wreckage from my past and present at that point in time. But I just didn't want to face it anymore. And, I felt that it was a lot wiser for me to leave and go elsewhere. You know, I wanted to do one of those geographical changes. And in the process of that, I found a treatment center down here in Phoenix, Arizona, and I traveled from Phoenix, Arizona, or from Colorado to Phoenix. Got here, got off the bus. Before I got off the bus, though, I looked around, and it was like December 19, 2004. People are running around in goose-down jackets and hoodies, and they looked really bundled up, and I was thinking I didn't bring a coat. And then I stepped off the bus. And I thought I'd found heaven, or a piece of it. And I went across the street, got on the bus, went to the street and center, tried to get in. They wouldn't let me in right away. I don't think they understood how sick I was. They made me wait like 30 days. But in the course of that 30 days, some miraculous things started to take place in my life. You know, I started to get this feeling inside that I needed to make some changes. I just didn't know what they were. And I didn't have direction. I didn't know what direction to go. Anyways, I finally got into the treatment center. You know, I share that I'm a quick learner. Any quick learners in here? Yeah. There's a 28-day program, and, you know, I'm grateful today. But it only took me 49 days to make it through that program. You know, and what I've realized more and more in my life is things happen like that. And what I'm starting to come into an awareness of is that it's God working in my life today. And for me, that's part of spirituality. this program is about. You know, I got out of that program, and they told me things like getting a sponsor, and we've all heard it, and work the steps and do the deal. And I'm in Phoenix, Arizona. I don't know anybody, and I know one person, and that's where I was staying. And you know, I knew that I needed to stay sober, because when I was in the treatment center, my eyes started to open up just a little bit at a time. And I started to see things, and I started to hear things that I'd never heard before. And I started to get a definition that didn't match the definition that I had lived in my life prior to that. And so I got one of them sponsors, and I worked the steps. And, you know, I positioned myself close to a halfway, or close to a clubhouse, so I could keep meetings on a regular basis. When I was sitting in this treatment center, there was a room of about 28 of us, and what they told me was that in one of the groups, they said that there, at 5 years, there's only going to be 3 of you out of 28 left that are still sober. And I thought about that, and I made a decision. And that's what I've learned about this program, and I've learned about spirituality, is it's about making the decision. It's about following through. And about doing the things that I might not necessarily want to do. I made the decision I was going to be one of those. My sobriety date's January 20th, 2005. God willing, I'll have 10 years. That's definitely not where I thought I would be 10 years ago. You know, 10 years ago, I swore I'd never own a computer. Is that Temple Sam's way of knowing what I'm doing? You don't have to know what I'm doing, you know? You know, electronics scared me. Not something I wanted to be a part of. And what's happened for me is that I started practicing the principles of this program in everything that I do. And doors started opening up, and I didn't want to walk through them. I was afraid. And, you know, I continued to walk through these doors. I can tell you today that I have a Class 1 clearance, fingerprint clearance card, that I didn't think I was ever going to get. But I have one, and it entitles me and gives me the ability to be able to work with children in my life. The spirituality in that is that I walk through a lot of fear in the process of that. You know, this program teaches us about a fourth step and a fifth step. I can tell you that I did a fourth step, a fifth step, and I didn't admit to my sponsor. I admitted to God and to the whole world the nature of my wrongs. That's public record. I can tell you when I filled that application out, there were 17, I had to write an account of 17 different arrests that I had been involved in, you know, and they allowed me a good cause exception. You know, I can tell you, I had to go back to Colorado, and I had to turn myself in, because when I left the state of Colorado, I was convicted. And I can tell you I was scared, and I was worried, and I didn't know the outcomes. And this was at about 16 months of sobriety. But I've learned in this program that it's about faith, and it's about doing what's in front of you. And it's about trusting in God. And I have to leave the results up to Him. I went back to Colorado, I turned myself in, I faced charges, I did my time, I walked away. You know, I was sentenced on my 6th DUI when I was in jail there. I was actually in jail for a probation violation. I can tell you that the day that I turned myself in to do my time, I knocked on the window, and they came to the window, and they said, "Hello, Dennis, how are you doing?" And they said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "What I'm doing here is that I've come to turn myself in." And they went and they looked, and they couldn't find my minimus. I don't know if everybody knows what a minimus is. It's your sentencing order. And I begged them to let me back, to let me in. And that's not something that I would do. That's something that is a gift of working these steps, reaching out my hand and helping other people in this world. Until you have a beautiful relationship today with a daughter who's 35 years old, 34. Don't have any more years there. and she's turned out to be this spiritual guru of my life today. You know, our conversations are about crystals and rocks and God and her conception of what God is in her life today. And I get to share in that. I can tell you that I showed up to take care of an amends, and I didn't know what the amends was. I didn't know how to make the amends. I talked to my sponsor. I talked to a lot of other people. I did what I have been taught in this program. And I can tell you that we had dinner together, and I was on my way. We were on our way back. She was getting ready to drop me off, and she asked me a question, and the question was as simple as this. Do you know where my mom lived when she was growing up? And I can tell you that she lost her mom 4 years ago because of that. And, you know, God knew that I had the answer to that question. And that opened up a huge door for her and I. She was ready to heal. I see that today. I was able to take her around and show her some of the places that she had lived, where her mother lived when she was growing up. Because I lived a block and a half away. I was able to show her where I lived and tell her the story and bring it all back together for her. These are the things I get to do today. These are the things I get to show up for. Somebody approaches me at this meeting, at this conference, and asks me to set up here on this panel and to share. And my first instinct is to go no. Because I don't do well in front of a lot of people. But God's working on that. Because not only am I sitting here in front of you now, but I'm also the Grapevine coordinator for the state of Arizona. So I get to stand up in front of a lot of people. And I get to work through that fear. And I get to make presentations, and I get to be a part of life today.
Yeah, is
there
a staff or not? That's probably a staff.
Which is definitely not where I thought I would be. You know, what I've learned about spirituality in my life today is that everything that I have gone through and experienced in my life is meant to be, and that I don't have to know today what it is that I had to go through, whatever it was I had to go through. But I know that there's a purpose behind it. I can tell you today I work in a field where I work with, and this is God's sense of humor in my eyes. I get to set in courtrooms. I get to work with children and their parents, some of them who are active in the disease. I get to work with juvenile probation officers. I work with the Department of Child Safety, formerly CPS. I didn't know that that's where this was going. I didn't know that all the times that I sat in court as a victim, of my own, that those were the things that were going to help me further down the road. I can tell you that when I got this position as a Grapevine coordinator, one of the things that I said in my resume, my service resume, was that I have a driver's license today. I have a car. It's legally registered and has insurance. In my name. You know, that's a gift for me today. Because I can tell you that there was a period of 17 years of my life where I was illegally able to drive. I'm extremely filled with gratitude to be here and to be a part of this panel. I think that's probably about my 20 minutes. I have 15, 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. I'm going to pass to
Kendall.
Yeah. Thanks for letting me say this.
I got to sit in the middle.
Yeah.
I'm an alcoholic. My name is Ken.
Hi, Ken.
I walked into an AA meeting on a Saturday morning, 9 a.m., July 27th, 26th, 27th, 1980. And I had a choice at that point to be at that meeting or to be put into a state hospital. And when I walked into that meeting, I met a man in there named Pat B., who was a little Irish guy, a retired steelworker, who never got through high school because he had to quit and support his family. The man oozed spirituality. The man oozed a sense of, my God, I want what this man has. And I couldn't even define what he had because I didn't know anything about him. I had no clue. You know, today I sit and I cringe when people say, I want to talk to you about the spiritual part of this program. Because as far as I'm concerned, this whole program is spiritual. There's no part. You know, and it begins for me. You know, I spent 12 years in religious schools and then into the seminary. So it took me a long time to figure out what spirituality was. Because I knew what religion was, but I didn't know what spirituality was. You know? And I make that distinction because I believe in our recovery, one can push us apart and the other could pull us together. You know, because you and I being different, I may have beliefs that you don't have. And if I'm talking to you about theology, I could push you away because you may not believe what I believe in that sense. But if I talk to you about spirituality, I'm hoping that we're pulling together because as far as I'm concerned, the basis of my spirituality had to be the fact that I allowed you to become a part of me again and allowed myself to become a part of you even more. Because when I was drinking and using drugs, I certainly was not a part of you. And I was not a part of anything. I was not even a part of me. So that's the beginning for me. It has to be, I have to allow you in. Because it says in my first tradition, and I didn't follow ours, not just mine, but it talks about our common welfare coming first. And our recovery depending upon the unity of one another, and that's an incredibly important thing to me today. You know, the unity of a group of people who probably, for whatever reason, should never be talking to each other. Yeah, I mean, probably most of us would never have met if it were not for the gift of this disease. You know? And I say the gift of this disease because if I did not have this disease, I would not know what a spiritual life was. Because I would have no reason to know it at that point. I would have no reason to seek it out. I would have no reason to talk to you. I would have no reason to be with you. And you teach me. You know, it's like being with you, listening to you, talking to you, I begin to understand what life is about. Therefore, I begin to understand what spirituality is about, because spirituality to me today has to be in absolutely everything I do in my life. There's no difference, you know. And I believe that with the steps, too. I have this crazy-ass sponsor that insists that I put the steps and traditions into my everyday life, and that I learn to live them in everything I do. I understand powerlessness in my relationships to you and the things that I do on a daily basis. So I used to joke and say, my most difficult time with the concept of powerlessness in a spiritual sense is the grocery store. And most of the time in the checkout line in the grocery store. And most of the time when I'm the one being checked out. You know, and it's not so much that anybody's stealing, it's just that the kid that's bagging my groceries is trying to get laid with the cash for the cashier. And he's not paying a damn bit of attention to put ways to open my bread and shit. And I really want to get angry, you know. But understanding that, you know, I don't need to become unmanageable in situations. And that's, you know, and that first step is a basis, again, that I learned from you, that is a part of me and having a spiritual life. You know, understanding my powerlessness. You know, I don't talk to you too much about, I never talk too much about a description of my power greater than myself, because, to be honest with you, the longer I stay sober, the longer I'm clean, the less I know. And the more I believe that, who the hell am I anyway to believe that I can understand what this power is, who this power is, and, you know, the relationship that I have to have with that is faith that there is a power greater than me. And I have that through you most of the time. Yeah. Understanding that I am not a power greater than myself, which I thought I was for many years. That worked out well for most of us, didn't it? Because we're sitting here, kind of. And this is the best place to be. When I was asked to come up here, Nick, nice to see you. When I was asked to come up here and be a part of this panel, I thought to myself, how do I know about spirituality? And what can I say? What can I say about something that is what we do every day? You know, the relationship that we have with each other. The concept of living those steps and living those traditions in our lives, becoming a part of, and you'll hear me go back to keep becoming a part of, because that's really important to me, you know, and you know, my wife laughs every once in a while, but, you know, when I say that, because even today it's difficult for me to be, I'm the type of person that would much rather sit and be with my dogs, my cats, my horses, and books, you know, and not be around you. I'm uncomfortable around you. I always will be uncomfortable around you, and that's okay. I accept that today. And that's a part of accepting who I am. That's a part of my spirituality, understanding that I don't need to, like, be okay with absolutely everything. I can be uncomfortable. That doesn't mean I don't have to be here with you, because I can't not be here with you. You know, I tried that. I was 17 years sober, and I decided that I knew absolutely everything I needed to know. I didn't need you anymore. I didn't need meetings. I didn't need you. I didn't need a sponsor, nor did I need to sponsor anyone. I was living in Brooklyn, New York at the time, and the fun part about that was everything happened to me. I was exactly as I was when I was drinking and using drugs, except I wasn't drinking and using drugs. But all my behaviors, all my attitude, moving away from you, everything came back. The only reason I'm sitting here today is because six bikers showed up at my door. And my son let them in. And left. And they began to confront me about my attitudes, my behaviors, all that was going on. And my first reaction, of course, being self-righteous, is who do you think you are? But looking at the situation, I thought, maybe I better not do that. And they ended up staying for a week with me, sleeping on my floor, the loft I had. And we went to meetings, back to meetings, and back to where we needed to be. Had to take them to Junior's for cheesecake, but hell, you know. But the bottom line is, you know, they stayed with me until they believed that I was back where I needed to be. And to me, that's the way this works. You know, we cannot do this without each other. I cannot do this without you. I don't know if you could do it without me, but I can't do it without you. And I go back to Pat B that I met the first time I walked in the rooms. And I still want to be that man. I want that sense of when he walked in the room, all people saw was this light, I'm sure, because that's what I saw. I saw this light, you know, and there he was. And he didn't even have to open his mouth. And when he opened his mouth, it was always something about him caring about you, wanting to know about who. He didn't give a shit whether you knew what was going on with him. He wanted to know what's going on with you. He wanted to be there for you. He wanted to support you. And in that essence, of course, everybody wanted to support him. It's the way it is. We're all sitting here we all came here to this room for the same reason, because we're all searching for the same things. You know? And it doesn't matter how long we've been sitting in these chairs, we'll be searching for the rest of our lives. Somebody told me once, and I believe it, might be my sponsors. When I find it, I've already lost it. And I believe that because, you know, I think about how many times I started to believe who I thought I was. Okay? And how many times I lost that person. That person went away because, you know, had nothing to do with anything. You know? It's very simple for me today. You know, I'm an alcoholic. I'm an addict. I'm in a process of recovery that I'm grateful for. Because if it wasn't for the opportunity to do that, I would not know you. And I'm grateful for the fact that we're sitting here, because there's a whole shit ton of people out there who never had the opportunity we do. And that's scary to think about. You know, they're never going to have the ability to learn that we can have steps in our lives, traditions in our lives, people in our lives. They're never going to understand that we can lead life in a spiritual manner and understand what that truly is, you know. And again, understanding what that truly is for me means I really don't understand it. But that's why I'm here. You know, that's why I listen to Dennis, that's why I listen to Angel, that's why I listen to a friend of mine. That's why I'm so glad to see a bunch of people I haven't seen for a while, you know. Because I go to meetings in other places and I don't see a whole lot of people I used to see. And I'm really grateful for that group. I have a brother. Well, I have a shit ton of those. I always used to tell people my father was very prolific, but not very domestic. Well, a whole bunch of brothers and sisters. But I'm the only one. My father died an active alcoholic And I'm the only one in my family who has been given the gift of finding this process with each other. But I bring it up because I have a brother, because I talk a lot about, I have to remember him, because I talk a lot about people do not have, all people do not have the opportunity to do this. And when we're given the chance to do this, I believe it is a duty for me, spiritually, to take advantage of that. Because I believe that everybody sitting in this room, how many of us should have been dead more than once? Yeah. A couple of us probably were. And they probably brought you back to life. But the bottom line is, we're sitting here because there's something that we're supposed to do with our lives that maybe we haven't done yet. And we're given another chance to do that. Whatever that may look like, and sometimes it's going to be this big, and sometimes it's going to be this big, and I don't have any idea what that's going to be, because I didn't figure I was going to live past 29 years old. And I lived like I wasn't going to live past 29 years old. Now I'm 62 and I have no idea what I'm supposed to do with my life. So I just keep coming here, figure one of you guys going to tell me. But I bring up my brother because my brother's just like me and you. He's 20 years younger than me. He's next to the baby. I just talked to the baby not too long ago, and he said, I thought he was dead. I said, no, I'm still here. But this one, when he was 18 years old, was lucky and ended up in an accident. And he's a quadriplegic. And, God, whoever that is usually very kind to quadriplegics, and they don't live that long. And I say that in a sense that, because living in that sense is kind sometimes, and we don't have to. To me, anyway. But he's still alive. And he can't do anything but blink his eyes. He can't move. He can't talk. He can't do anything but blink his eyes. So he has people around him all the time. They learn to communicate with him. And something said to me once, holy shit, if I had to live that way, I'd commit suicide. So what is he going to do? Blink his eyes too fast? He doesn't even have a choice. And that's what I'm talking about. There are people out there who will never have this gift. And I asked all, every day, for a long time, I asked whoever that I was asking, why am I sitting here and why is that kid lying there? Because God knows I've done 10,000 times more than that kid's ever done in my life. And I don't know the answer, and I'm not supposed to know the answer, but I do know that I am here, and you're here, and that we're here because there's something we're supposed to do. And that today is a part of the spirituality of my life, trying to understand what it is I'm supposed to do on a daily basis by learning and being with you. I think my time's up. So, thanks. Guess what? It's your turn.
My butts. So if anybody feels like standing up and stretching, join me. Come on. Richard, reach for the love. Reach. And breathe. Okay. That's the connection right there. That's all there is. I will stand to speak with you because I want to see all of you. And Kate, I can see you very well. Hi there, don't see. My name is Angel Knight Woods. And I have not had a desire to take a drink since July the 7th, 1971. That's 43 big ones. I live born in 1925, and for those of you who are mathematically challenged, I'm 88. I'm 11 history book. When I was very, very young, a little over 3 years old, the fairy came and sat by my bed, and she said, "You have come to teach." I was delighted to see her because she was very beautiful. And I started to ask her a question, and she started to fade through the window. It was early in the spring. We had storm windows, and she went through into the elm tree that is still at that house where I grew up. I opened somehow that double-latched window and was able to get out on the roof and to see her go. I ran down to my grandparents. I was reared by my grandparents and said, "The fairy has been here." And they said, "Darling, you just go back to sleep. You've been dreaming." Out of body experiences and various paranormal experiences have come to me in most of my life, most of which I ignored because I was brought up in the Methodist Church, which has changed a great deal, thank God. Because back then, you know, hail and brimstone. And I remember they had one time had a evangelist come, and my grandmother said she didn't need to be evangelized or saved again. She was perfectly fine. Thank you. My grandparents were amazing people for their time. I had, from my earliest recollection, which some people tell me was at the age of 1 and a half, when my parents broke up, the knowledge of what was going on. From that time, I knew I was different. Everybody else had parents that lived together. Divorce was unheard of. My parents were divorced. I had the great, great good luck to have grandparents that were well off and who loved me and provided for me with everything that I ever needed, which caused great dissent in the family. And let me tell you, when I was, well, the Second World War comes in this, not the Civil War, the Second World War. In any case, I was 16 when I graduated from high school and made very good grades. I'm the oldest of my cousins on both sides, and I held it over them, or their family did, for the rest of their lives, practically. If she could do it, you can, for God's sake. And I don't know why they still speak to me, but the ones that are not dead. I'm the oldest on both sides of my family, and you men really fall fast. Because the next ones to me are males, and they're dead. Mm-hmm. I mean, and in any case, I went away to school. I can tell you of the bombing of Pearl Harbor, which I don't think you need really to know, but I do want to repeat because this is who I am and my spiritual experiences, that we were one. The nation was one. And I felt that and the people that were killed were friends. One died on the death march, the town. All of these things affect me. I went away to the University of Minnesota because I'm from the Illinois and live 35 miles from the University of Illinois. Now, I've got two states away. I have three grandchildren that live in Laguna Beach who went clear across the nation. I mean, they really were escaping. I'm very happy to say, by the grace of a power greater than myself, that they have never seen me drink. I was a drinking mother. I have two daughters. My first two children were boys. They died. I drank a long time over that. I married a war hero, 82nd Airborne, Battle of the Bulge. Even that's in history books. And we started to be the all-American family. In 10 years, I knew that marriage was over, and I had two daughters. I had no way to comprehend what to do with this. And I had prayed, and I had prayed, and nothing had occurred as far as I could see at that time. I was 31 years old, and I was walking on the beach in front of our house on Lake Michigan. And I called out to the universe, "Is this all there is?" And the word came back, "Yeah, this is it." And I said, "Okay." And what was wrong with that picture? It was the perfect American picture. The oil paintings, the sterling, the goblets, country club. Two beautiful children, a successful husband. Why could I not accept this? Oh, and by the way, in that atmosphere, you have pedigreed cats and dogs who do not bollocks up the decor. They have to go with the colors. Seemed okay to me. All of it out there. In that time, up until that time, I had tried to be a mainstream American. Look at all I had. Look at all that was good. And yet, it was, exception of my daughters, hardly anything to me. It was an expectation that I would have these things. And when I had them, I didn't want them. I didn't know why. I tried religion. I couldn't stomach that. I was once the treasurer of my church. They never knew how... the rest of the treasurers must have been stealing because everybody was so happy with that I turned in all the money, I guess. I never did quite figure that one out. From the time I was 31, I began to drink for the effect. I didn't get drunk every day for a long, long time. My daughters were 14 and 18 in 1971 when I got sober. And that by that time, I was a daily drinker. I could not live without alcohol, but it had come to the place where it no longer worked. And a day like any other day, and I know not why, I did not know why then, but I do know why now, that I called out to the universe and said, "God, help me." the fascinating thing is that it was immediately taken away. I did not ever want to have a drink again. I've never thought of having it. I'm not a drinking person. From that time forward, of course, what you had was an enraged woman. I don't say mad, I say enraged. I mean, let's not pretty it up. I was ready to kill. And you know damn well who I wanted to kill. And I came to you people, and there were very, very few women then. There were a couple of honest streetwalkers. They got paid for what they gave away. And I kept thinking, God, that would have been nice. Why didn't I try? Jesus Christ.
Oh, man.
Oh, well. And I came to you people, and they were mostly men, and they had what they call, I would call, they had these drunk-a-logs that are really travel logs. What they did was they talked about how they ran around the country drinking, trying to get laid. And the thing was, they were all blackout drinkers, and they didn't know if they did or not. But they talked about it forever, all the time. And then they would say such things, if you want what we have, you do what we did. Huh? The thing that got me was these idiots were happy. They were having the best goddamn time talking about all their stupid things they'd done, and God knows they had been. I mean, I was playing. I mean, those people had adventures when they drank. When I drank, I mean, you know, I had to be the social person with the husband and all of that crap. And it simply was beyond me that they were having so much fun when they drank, because when I drank, particularly up in the last 5 years, I had a bottle of JB, a pitcher of water, a bucket of ice, an ashtray this big, and three packages of cigarettes. If you're going to drink, goddammit, let's get down to it. I drank in quantity. You know what those flat asses said to me? We probably spilled more than you drank. Spilled? Who spills? I mean, come on, get off it. So I got a sponsor, and in those days, I mean, I can't even keep one of my goddamn sponsees here. See, she's leaving.
I've heard this 10 times.
Love you. Love you too. Bye. Okay. These steps made amends. First time I made amends to my ex-husband, he informed me of every goddamn thing I'd ever done. And so 5 years later, I said, you know, went to see where he was. Oh, by the way, we were divorced in the first year. I remember when we were in Honolulu at the, I was 6 weeks sober, and we were at the Hawaiian, the Royal Hawaiian in the tower, and had, it was a business trip, and we had the hospitality room. And I would go into the bathroom to say the serenity prayer. I tried to get in touch with AA from the number I had, and no one answered, and I finally called information on the last day I was there. And found out where the meeting was. And as you, those who know me, know I usually am decked out properly for what a middle-class, middle-aged woman. I'm kind of past middle age, maybe. It's tricked out. And what I did was I grabbed a scarf and put it over my head, went downstairs, got a limo, went to the meeting, and the limo driver said, "Are you sure you want to leave, get out here?" I said, "Yes." And it was in the worst part of the Pier District in Honolulu. And anyway, I got to the meeting, and at the end of it, I said, "Where's the phone? I need to call for a cab." And a rather magnificent, huge, God damn, he was big, Polynesian, and a handsome, beautiful black man in a car that you had to, couldn't open it over here. You had to go in this way through the driver's seat, you know, scooch over. So here I am in the middle of these humongous people driving back to the Royal Hawaiian, and the people anyway, I got out of the car. They got out of the car, and I hugged both of them. I was so happy. It was one of them, and people were looking at me strangely. They did not understand that those two people and the ones with them had saved my life. They had saved my life. And that was part of reaching out beyond that which I understand. Because my program says, on page 10 of the big book, a spirit of the universe that knows neither time nor limitation. So I'm not interested in your he, she, gods. I am interested in a universal spirit of the universe that exists in every one of us. And all you have to do is to breathe. 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 And you will connect. That is really all there is to it. And through your prayer and your meditation, you reach beyond that which you understand. That which I have just said is old news. Forward, always seeking, always reaching, always being to be of service to them. That is my job. The fairy came. She said, "You have come to teach. And it is you who have taught me. Thank you."